Have you heard about the knowing-doing gap? It's the problem that faces many businesses. Knowing what they want to do and achieve, but falling short on execution. We'll give you a 5-point checklist to bridge the gap so that you're better equipped for executional excellence.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Per Byland is with us again today, and Per recently released one of his justly famous Twitter streams. By the way, we should be congratulating him on building his personal brand by inventing what is essentially a new medium. This one was on the subject of execution. Business ideas are not scarce, he says, but excellence in execution is. The implication for entrepreneurs is to really study hard to understand what comprises excellence in execution. Interestingly, there's not much study material. There are a few business books on execution, but those that exist are not actually useful. Everyone wants to talk about strategy and planning. There's a 2002 book by Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan, revised in 2009, that tells us that execution is a discipline, a process, a frame of mind. It has chapters about creating frameworks and strategy reviews. And neither of those things are very executional. The best one I've come across is Think Like Amazon by former Amazon executive John Rossman. There are 50 of what Rossman calls ideas in the book, and some of them are execution, and they're really valuable. Similarly, there are 14 leadership principles, some of which can be applied in execution. Since Amazon is a company that executes with excellence, I believe there are some good pointers here. Moreover, we can organize some of the core principles and ideas in Think Like Amazon under Austrian value creation headings. And those are these. First, consumer sovereignty. The consumer is the boss, and what the consumer says goes. Two, subjective value, and specifically value as experience. Third, dynamic resource allocation based on Austrian capital theory. We've talked with Per about that. Fourth, dynamic organization with residual entrepreneurial control, i.e. make your organization design as dynamic as you can. We talked with Peter Klein about that. And measuring the right things and taking action as a result. So we'll take those five principles. Think Like Amazon has, as I said, 50 ideas and 14 leadership principles. So we're cramming the world of entrepreneurial implementation into five headings. We recognize the compression, but the value is still there for you. See what you think as we discuss these five principles of Austrian execution with Per Byland. And if you'd like to give some extra attention to principle five, measuring the right things, Dr. Byland and I would like to invite you to give us some of your thoughts and ideas. Entrepreneurship is about creating value, and value is subjective. So how do you measure it? Measurement is usually thought of as objective. We'll give you our thoughts when we discuss principle five. And then at the end of the podcast, we'll ask you to give us your innovative ideas on measuring subjectivity. It's a place where we can revolutionize business. Let's now talk to Per Byland. Per, hello.
Hi, Hunter. Good talking to you again.
It's always good to have you here, and thanks for returning. We're going to talk today about execution. We often talk about ideation and imagining the future, you and I, but a responsibility of the entrepreneur that's equally important, perhaps more so for business success, is excellence in execution. And in fact, recently you released one of your Twitter streams, a medium that you have mastered, and I characterized this one as the idea of execution is more important for entrepreneurial success than ideation is. So let's start there. What were you thinking of when you issued that tweet stream?
Well, I think it's a common mistake by entrepreneurs, and I see this all the time in speaking with the general public and my entrepreneurship students as well, that people are, they have this idea that if you just have a great idea as an entrepreneur, everything else will basically sort itself out. And the problem is figuring out this marvelous idea, and then you can just sit back and start counting the money, because you're making loads of profit. Mm-hmm. And as an entrepreneur knows, it's not that easy. You can have a great idea and it fails miserably, and you can have an okay idea and that still works out really well. And I mean, if you look at how venture capitalists and investors in businesses, what they're actually looking for, an idea is good, but what they're really interested in is seeing, is this the guy or gal who can pull this off? Can this business really make it happen? That's what's important. Not did they have an interesting idea? I mean, that's obviously a bonus, but it's the execution that matters. And we see this all the time in technology, for instance, where it's hardly ever the case that the first mover gets all the profit. And in terms of tablets, for instance, people nowadays think of the iPad as the first tablet, but that was hardly the first tablet. There was the Newton that Apple had long before then. There was an Android tablet the year before the first iPad, but it never took off. But there was even the tablet PC that Microsoft tried to launch some 10 years before the iPad. But those are all forgotten now, but those were the first movers, and obviously a tablet-style computer was an idea that was good enough to make loads of money and change how people behave and change our lives in a sense, but they just couldn't pull it off. And these were not some schmucks sitting at home in a garage trying stuff. I mean, Microsoft and Google are pretty pretty well-funded and big corporations with lots of very smart people, but they still couldn't pull it off. So it was not the idea itself, because Apple basically copied that idea, but they just tweaked it a little bit. So they changed the execution of what the tablet should be and how it can be launched to people and so forth. And so very often, the first mover sort of finds, I would call it a value space maybe, or find sort of a problem that consumers have that they can offer a solution to. But the first attempt is very often not a very good one. It might satisfy consumers by solving the problem, but whoever comes second will see ways to improve the product, or improve the packaging, or improve the sort of positioning of the product. And they will also not have to make all the mistakes that the first mover made. So very often a second mover is the best position in a sense to take, if you can't choose one, because you don't have to make all the mistakes, and you can sort of perfect the ideas that were already launched. And how do you perfect them? Well, it's not by adding a great idea. It's by executing the already established idea in a better way. And that's how you make the money.
Right. In the corporate innovation world, we used to classify innovation possibilities at three levels. The highest level was new to the world, a genuinely new idea, new concept that had never been done. The second was new to the company. And whatever company you're working for, you may not have invented the field, as you say, the value field, but you had the opportunity to dive in and maybe do it better. And the third level was incremental improvement, which was, we already make this product. or somebody does, but we can do it better. And the portfolio needs a lot more incremental improvement items than new to the world items, because new to the world items are very seldom successful. So execution there is incremental improvement. Let's look at the implementation task pair and try to illustrate. I talked in my intro today about five principles of Austrian economics that can help entrepreneurs be great executors. So the first one is consumer sovereignty, the principle that consumers decide what's the highest value, what's the best execution, and profit is a result of that, satisfying that customer need. So the customer's the boss. The customer decides what's best. And I also referred in my intro to a book about Amazon, Think Like Amazon, where they talk about consumer obsession, which is a lovely term, I think, because it really focuses execution on what does the consumer want. So let's talk about that under the heading of execution. Consumer sovereignty helping entrepreneurs to do a great execution job.
Right. So I think a consumer obsession is a great way of putting it. And it's fascinating to me that all these descriptions of these great ideas that great companies are built around are almost always very Austrian ideas. I mean, consumer obsession is simply putting all your efforts into satisfying the consumer. What does the consumer want? How can we satisfy the consumer? How can we provide more value to the consumer? And of course, the more value you offer to the consumer, the higher price you can charge for the product, which means it's easier to cover your costs, and you can probably have a little leeway in terms of improving the product as well and launching a second generation and a third generation and so forth. And that's exactly what we see already in Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian School of Economics back in 1871. He started with the consumer too. So, I mean, he was obsessed in a very Amazonian way with the consumer as well. But I mean, how do you do it? Since we're talking about execution, that is the hard part. I mean, the first step is to recognize that the consumer is everything, and we are nothing as a company and as entrepreneurs unless we figure out how to satisfy the consumer in whatever way. But it's always on the consumer's own terms, and hence consumer sovereignty, right? But it's about knowing people. It's about understanding the psychology of the customer. It's about understanding how they lead their lives, maybe what their dreams are, what their goals and aims for the future are, things like that. Putting yourself in their shoes. And how do you get to understand your customer like that? I mean, I don't think there's an alternative to getting your hands dirty. In a sense, I would say that entrepreneurs, when they have identified sort of a target audience or a beachhead market or their preferred market segment or whatever term you want to use, they should act in a sense like anthropologists. So think of the anthropologist going to some sort of tribe somewhere and living with them, getting to know their ways and their culture and getting to understand how they reason about things, how they think about things. And it's really about getting that kind of tacit understanding for who is this person or this type of person, and how can I tweak my product and make my offering as appetizing as possible for this type of person. And you can sit at home philosophizing on what kind of person might it be, what kind of dreams might he or she have, and so forth. But that can take you only so far. You still need to talk to the customer. You still need to interact with the customer. Maybe invite the customer to be part of the product development process. Make sure that the customer gets to touch and feel your product and provide you feedback. So, I mean, it's all about the hands-on, really, and you need to be, in a sense, be a people person, or a person to be a good entrepreneur.
That's right, Per. And before we summarize your points about how to get better at responding to customer sovereignty, let's take a quick break here to remind listeners that this week we're asking for their input. We'd like to know about the ways in which you, our listeners, have measured or attempted to measure subjective value in your own customers. How is it that you determine whether or not your customers love your product or service and how much they love it? Head to our Facebook page, LinkedIn page, or email me at hunter@mises.org with your ideas, and we'll discuss some of them the next time that Dr. Byland and I get together on the podcast. Now back to today's conversation. So how we do better at responding to consumer sovereignty, we've said deep study. You make it part of your culture and what you do as an entrepreneur and a company. Deep listening and deep empathy. And let's stick with that word obsession. I like it too. The consumer obsession. Well, they say in the book that companies that obsess behave differently. And that seems reasonable in terms of the learning that you're going to get from consumers. So within that consumer obsession pair, there's another Austrian principle of subjective value. That what is valuable is defined by what the consumer perceives, not by any objective assessment of how well it works or how well it's made. And there's a couple of thoughts that come up there, and maybe you've got better ones. But one way to capture subjective value that I know of from my own personal history is creating a brand. A brand's a receptacle into which the consumer can project their perception of value. And I always like to use the example of vodka. You know, vodka's a clear liquid that's essentially the same coming out of every bottle, but obviously the bottles are different, the packaging are different, the brand image is different, the social circumstances in which you consume it are different. It's a brand of vodka can be perceived as special and unique, even though the liquid is pretty generic. So brand is one way to do subjective value or capture subjective value. Do you agree with that? And do you have any additional thoughts around that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. What you're selling, this is something that we've covered before, but that we should probably repeat more often, is that what you're selling is not actually the product. What you're selling is how the consumer uses it and how the consumer experiences it. So it's all really about the satisfaction in value terms for the consumer. So vodka itself, you can potentially sell vodka in plastic bags. And I doubt consumers would be willing to pay a lot for vodka in plastic bags. But if you sell it in a beautiful bottle, if you sort of communicate a specific feeling, if you provide them with the perception that this is a fancy drink or a better drink than something else, or if it's made from mineral water from France or whatever it is that the consumer might enjoy just knowing about the product, and thereby contribute to the value of consuming the product, that is the value you're contributing to him or her. That is a big part of it. So I mean, we shouldn't think of packaging and advertising and so forth as waste. That's part of the production process. That's part of how you contribute value to the consumer. Branding is a big part of this. It creates, in a sense, it creates a trust for the brand itself. That you've come to know a brand and you know that they will have a certain quality, or that you can use these products in a certain way, or maybe you rely on their customer service. If something happens, they will immediately just give you a replacement or whatever it is. But these types of promises that relieves you as a consumer from potential problems and therefore sort of a cost threshold for using the product. All of these things are part of the value of the product. But it is the perception in the eyes of the consumer which makes communication so important. I mean, you have these perception issues and trust issues in technology where you have sort of the traditional battle between Apple and Microsoft, where they used to have very different perceptions of these companies, where you, of course, have a very loyal Apple usership, where they are willing to pay 3, 4, 5, 10 times as much for a computer as long as it has an Apple on it, whereas they would never pay even half that for an identical computer that does not come from Apple. Whereas Microsoft was sort of struggling, at least in the consumer market, with having an identity that people were like, yeah, it's a whatever computer that is on an office desk, and it's a tool, but it has nothing else to offer. Whereas if you have Apple products, then that makes you at least think that you're more creative and all these other things that come with a brand. And of course, this is a great boon for a company if you have worked up a brand that people trust and that people are willing to pay a premium to buy your products. And it's also a problem if you don't have a brand like that. But this is not, I think people very often think of branding and such things as sort of fraudulent, where you're creating these perceptions that are not objectively true. So in that sense, you're cheating people. So when people are sleeping on the sidewalk for getting iPhone 11 or 12 or 13 or whatever it is, that they're fooled, because they could as easily get a different phone and pay just $100 and it works almost the same. But I mean, it's to an Austrian, that's ridiculous, because what you're doing as an entrepreneur is producing a good or service that provides value in use for the consumer. It's totally in the consumer's own eyes and consumer's own views, which makes you as an entrepreneur sort of in a sense, a slave to what consumers fancy. But it also means that this perception is part of the product. It's part of the value that you're offering.
Well, the principle, I think, is, as you say, the consumer decides what is valuable. And that decision comes as a result of a consumption experience. I sometimes think, and tell me whether you agree, that you've used the word that the entrepreneur facilitates value. They can't actually deliver it if the consumer is deciding on it. But sticking with the vodka example, if the consumer chooses Grey Goose and the experience they have when they drink it includes the social acceptance they have when they order it in public. They are respected at the bar, or it looks good in the home bar, and I feel proud when I'm serving it to my guests. Those are experiences, but the entrepreneur can't deliver those. They can just facilitate them, and then they have to find out whether the consumer experienced it. Is that right? That you kind of lose control of the experience to the consumer.
Exactly, and that's why we talk about consumer sovereignty, that whether it's something is actually valuable, you can't do anything about that as an entrepreneur. That's what the consumer decides. And you can attempt to speak to consumers' fancy or their preferences, or provide them with a certain perception and so forth through communication. But whether they accept it or not is still the consumer's own decision, the consumer's own choice. And just like you mentioned with the vodka example, it's not simply the liquid in the bottle that they're buying. If you go to a bar and you order Grey Goose vodka, even though as a Swede I would probably pick another brand, then the point is not that the liquid is different from the liquid in different bottles. The point is that it's Grey Goose vodka. That's a big part of the value. And so the value is knowing that you paid for this brand knowing that you like the brand for whatever reason, knowing that people saw you order Grey Goose vodka and not some cheap Polish vodka, and all of these things are part of the product package. And you can't decide that as an entrepreneur, but you can try to position your product with respect to these things that you have to sort of imagine that the consumer will see or do. But it's always on the consumer's own terms. So you can't really decide and provide something objectively, because it's always subjectively valued. And in a sense, I like, in my previous career, I came across a definition of quality that I know that the European consulting firm Capgemini was using back then. And they said that quality is to always exceed the customer's expectations. And that's very true. And it's also very Austrian. Mm-hmm. It pinpoints that quality is not what we do. Quality is how our customers see what we do, how our customers experience what we do. So it really places the customer at the center. It's consumer obsessive in the sense, but it's also pinpoints that it's not the objective deliverable, but it is their expectation of it and their experience of it. And we need to provide something that is at least what they expect, but hopefully even more.
Yeah, I think that's a great bar to set. But executional excellence can create that trust that you referred to earlier, maybe just by always meeting expectations. Jeremy Vester, who was with us earlier in the year, who runs a commodity company, a beef company. Actually, it's not commodity because he told us about all the things that they do to make it stand out. But he called operational excellence a value creation activity. Whatever you promise in terms of, in his case, the cut of the beef and the quality of the packaging, delivering it on time to the customer at the exact right price, precisely as promised, that was a piece of value creation. Because not everybody in his industry does that. So just by executing with excellence on time, right price, and so on, that created trust, which created a brand, which created a customer loyalty. So maybe just executing up to expectations is good enough sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, thinking of anybody that helps you out with your home, like plumbers and handymen and so forth. I mean, I think we all have the experience of how they tend to not deliver what they promise, or at least what we think that they promise. So there in many industries, I think that's exactly right. That if you just deliver exactly what you promise in the eyes of the consumer, of course, then that's enough of a competitive advantage.
Right. Making a promise and then keeping it, that's a great way to address subjective value and consumer sovereignty.
It seems obvious, right? But it's extraordinary how often things are promised, but they're simply not delivered.
Right. So we've covered a couple of the principles that we started out trying to explore, Per, about consumer sovereignty and subjective value. There's another one that is wrapped up in execution, and it seems really hard, but you've taught us about it a lot in previous conversation. That's dynamic capital resource allocation. So we understand that the value of capital, the value of resources, is simply a projection of the consumer value it's going to create in the future, expressed as a stream of dollars. And since the consumer is always changing, or the customer is always changing, the market's changing, you say the capital structure needs to be a reflection of that, needs to be always changing so that we've got exactly the right capital structure to serve our customers. That sounds really hard to execute. So let's explore that a little bit and tell us how you think entrepreneurs can execute that principle.
Right. So it's hard and it's expensive too. It's not simply responding to the changes that you see happening, because we talked about this a number of times, how what you need to do as an entrepreneur is try to meet the future, if not create the future. So if the world around you and your competitors, all of this is changing and you need to respond to it, then you're already behind them. So what you need to do as an entrepreneur, as we've mentioned a number of times, is try to figure out and imagine where consumers are going and what consumers will want from you as an entrepreneur and from the product or service that you're offering and what type of value that provides to them. So you should always sort of tinker with how you're producing and what you're producing and the structure of your product, what types of features you offer, and maybe what type of business model you have. All of those things should always be, in a sense, up for grabs, and you could choose to adjust those, even if it doesn't seem like you have a need to do that right now, considering the market. If you imagine and if you expect the market and your customers to change in a certain way, or you expect that technology will undermine part of your business, or any kind of change that would warrant an adjustment to how you do things and what you do, and in a sense why you do it as well, then you should immediately adjust to that. I mean, when we say that the capital structure in the economy is constantly changing, that is true, but what that means is simply that millions of entrepreneurs are constantly trying to figure out how to better serve consumers. And since they're constantly trying to do that, they're constantly figuring out new combinations of resources, new types of production processes, new structures internally, their organization, and things like that, trying the different things out because they think that the future will be different, or that they will make the future different. So that this capital structure is changing simply means that everybody else is trying to do what you should also be doing. So in a sense, if you are simply responding to the changes that you see around you, that means that you're already too late. You should, in a sense, take a step forward and make sure to lead the way and not just follow.
Yeah, I think Amazon, that we've been referring to today, is a great example of that. They've seen in the marketplace that the consumer values delivery, and we're always reading about them changing the configuration of their warehouses to make fast throughput more of a reality. They've told all of their suppliers to change their packaging so that it makes Amazon's warehouses more efficient. And they are apparently looking at drones and deliveries from Whole Foods in 2 hours. And they've massively invested in this idea of the consumer wants more and more convenience. And then they've also got the consumer to pay for it. You join Prime by paying in advance for all of this this delivery convenience. So they seem to have that ability to change their capital structure in response to the marketplace.
Exactly. And they also change how they're doing things internally. The people I've talked to who have worked in Amazon warehouses, I mean, it's not simply that you get a list and then pick these things up and then put them in a box, but you're even directed how to move to those shelves and pick those things up. And sometimes it will redirect you on a different route that doesn't seem to make any sense to you. And why? Well, simply because they're collecting data to see, does this save time? Does this save effort and whatever else there might be? But they're collecting data continuously, trying to figure out how to sort of optimize both, I think, the design and structure of the warehouse and the route that you will take to pick those things up. Of course, that's probably data that they will use when they automate the process and use drones or other types of robots and so forth to pick things from shelves and put things in packages and so forth.
Which is fine, but the entrepreneur has the opportunity to do the same thing today in the digital age. You can rent your capital, you can rent your computing power, you can rent all kinds of capabilities, and that means that you can change them quickly as well. So thinking about that capital structure as flexible is something that every entrepreneur can do, I think.
Absolutely. And I mean, outsource things. I think we've talked about this before, that if it's not necessary that you do it in-house, probably should outsource it, because that means you can adjust the level of output, you can adjust how much you use of a service depending on how much you happen to sell. So, I mean, the flexibility is not simply having a lot of slack in-house, but it's also making sure to outsource as much as possible, and not so much that you lose control of it, but still make sure to sort of play off of other businesses' advantages, because they have specific skills that you might not need to develop in-house.
Which gets us to our next flexibility, the fourth principle, and that's dynamic flexibility in the organization of people. So both of the authors that I referred to earlier talk about getting the right people in the right jobs, and they've got some tips on how to do that. But Austrians, I think, look at not just the right people, but empowering those people to do the right things without too much bureaucratic control. And that's a function of organization, and especially those who are customer facing, because they've got to constantly be adjusting to the customer based on what the consumer service call is that they're getting, or what's happening in the face-to-face interaction and so on. So we talk about the lowest amount of bureaucracy and the lowest amount of transaction costs. That's the economic term. How can entrepreneurs eliminate all of those things that get in the way of having people empowered to serve the customer?
Well, it's about thinking about consumer value and how do you satisfy a consumer. There's nothing more valuable to a business, in a sense, than a very satisfied consumer, because they will tell everybody else about your product and your company and how they love dealing with you and so forth. Unfortunately, many companies focus too much on cutting costs. But I mean, I think we all have the experience of calling into a customer service center with a faulty product or some kind of problem that we need to have solved. And the person you speak to simply does not have the authority or the understanding, and you cannot get any help from them, and you ask for this next level of support and so forth. But all they try to do is just make sure that you hang up, in a sense. And that's, I think that is a great way of killing your business, especially as an entrepreneur, because what you really need is to have consumers who are, in a sense, evangelists for your company, who really like what you're doing and trust your company. So it's about your brand and about making sure that people spread the word about how satisfied they are with your product and with you, how you handle them, and all of these things. And the way to do that is to not force people into very bureaucratic structures with very limited authority. So very often these customer service centers, what the people can do is very limited, and they can't make any special favors. They can't make any adjustments whatsoever. So it's all standardized protocol. And that very often does not fit with what you're asking for and the problem that you have and so forth. So you need to be dynamic and be able to adjust a little bit and be friendly and helpful. And that helps a lot. And I mean, the way to think about this, and we talked about this before too, is to always ask yourself, will this contribute to the satisfaction of the consumer? Is this contributing to the value that the consumer experiences dealing with us? Not simply by consuming the product, but dealing with us if there's, in terms of customer support and all this other stuff too. So any investment in the business, any person you hire, any machine you buy, any office you think of renting, and so forth, always ask yourself, the first question you should ask yourself is this for us internally? Because that's consumption. Or is this for consumers? Does this contribute directly to the value experienced by our consumers? Because if it does, then of course it's justified expense. If it's only for us internally, that could contribute indirectly to consumers, but it could simply also be, in a sense, waste of money or consumption rather than production of value.
Yeah, that's the perfect general principle, and you've given us one new idea, I think, as a execution of that. Is if you have any rules, like the rules that your customer service people have to follow, look at that rule and say, does that generate customer value, or does it get in the way of customer value? And that's a great piece of analysis.
Yeah, and I think that the reason those rules are in force are never ever to provide value to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Those are always to cut costs internally. But you can cut costs forever if you don't produce any value for consumers, because consumers will not pay for something that is not valuable. So you have to think value first.
Well, let's move on to our fifth principle. I call it the Austrian dashboard, which is a little bit of a fantasy because we haven't quite perfected it yet, but it's about measuring the right things. What are the things that consumers feel that matter, that create value, and how can the entrepreneur measure that? One idea I got from the Amazon book that we referred to is cash flow. Amazon operates on free cash flow. And Jeff Bezos says the reason why they do that instead of earnings is cash flow can be reinvested back in creating more customer value, more innovation, more initiatives, more capital. And earnings can't necessarily. They're just an accounting function. And so at the micro level, we recommend that entrepreneurs monitor cash flow and keep it positive, because without cash, nothing gets done. And also cash obviously reflects that the consumer is saying that you're delivering value. So that's a place to start on cash flow. Do you concur with that? Is cash flow as the core metric?
Absolutely. Cash is king. I mean, cash flow problems is probably the main reason why startups go under and simply cannot survive. Not because they're not making money in terms of measurable profit per product, but simply because there's more money going out of the business than coming in at this moment. So cash flow is definitely, and in terms of objective metrics, that's number one. But then you have all these other things trying to measure how consumers see your business and how they see the product and these things. And those are depend a little bit on what type of business you have, but I would say in general there are indications that you can use. And I mean, spontaneous praise, for instance, that this should be very important. If someone goes to social media or writes a review or something like that praising you, then obviously you did something right. But it's easier in general for people to complain than to praise a company, especially when they bought a product for money. So if there is spontaneous praise, then you should really look into that and ask what exactly was the reason for this praise and follow up on it, because that can teach you a lot on what you did right and who did it right. Because it might be a specific employee of yours that did something really, really well and really connected with this consumer. But there, in a similar vein, peer-to-peer recommendations and referrals are also very important. So, I mean, trying to record where this new customer comes from. Is it a customer who heard about your product from a friend or someone they trust who was really satisfied? Or did they just see an ad? Those are very different things, because the expectations of your business and what you deliver is different.
You've created another new metric there, the route to acquisition. So a lot of companies look at CAC, the cost of acquisition of a consumer, but you're saying, what's the route to acquisition? That's more important. I like that.
Right. And that's, again, I mean, just like we talked about a minute ago, the cost of acquisition, that again focuses on the cost. Whereas the, mm-hmm. the root of acquisition would focus on the value of it. Where does it come from? And I mean, the costs are important. I'm not saying that you shouldn't care about costs at all, but costs are secondary to value always.
What about this other metric, which is long-term value of a customer, which in a sense is measuring value creation? So I know that if I get a customer, they come to my website, they averagely spend $100 a year. They averagely last 2.5 years, so the long-term value is $250. Is that a good indicator of subjective value, do you think?
I guess it could be, but I would probably want some more detail. I mean, it could be the case that your product has poor quality, but it's still okay quality compared to other to competing products, which means consumers who might need this product come back and buy over and over again. Whereas it doesn't really say anything about whether you could increase the quality or if you could increase the value that they experience from the product and thereby have them pay a whole lot more. So it doesn't, it provides you an indication of what is going on potentially, but it doesn't give you a direction of where to go from here.
What about, is there a way to trend a consumer's satisfaction? So we've got spontaneous praise, and can we measure whether or not they maintain that? Are they getting more or less satisfied over time? Have you ever come across any metrics of that kind?
I mean, many companies, at least larger corporations, they have sort of boards or councils, small groups of consumers whom they basically hire and ask for their opinion over and over again. So you can do these type of polling. I'm not sure how valuable that is for an entrepreneur, especially an entrepreneur who is innovative and wants to disrupt a market, because that's more for a mature business. And you can also do brand perception surveys and things like that. But when it's very costly, but I would say sitting down and chatting with customers, meeting up with customers, maybe taking them to lunch or coffee or something like that, if you have the ability to do so, that's how you learn what they really think, and that sort of can get a tacit understanding for what they value and why they value it, and how to move on from here. How can you improve the product and the offering, and what is it with your company that they trust? What is it that they see in competitors' products or their offering, and so forth?
Good. So I think this is a really interesting research field that we can look at, and that is, how can we monitor these kinds of qualitative and subjective metrics? There's a lot of talk about dashboards, but they're always trying to create quantitative data out of what is essentially qualitative. So you talked about a perception survey that's doing exactly that, trying to put numbers on something that is not numerical. So let's...
Yes. And but it's also important, I think, to not over-quantify. So, I mean, since we're talking about the subjective value experience by consumers, we can, of course, ask them survey questions, and we can rank them on a Likert scale. So, from 1 to 7, what do you think of this product? And things like that. But it's going from there to saying that, in general, the 1,000 customers that we talked to and surveyed, they think that our product is a 4 on this 7-point scale. That doesn't help us all that much, because there are probably going to be customers who are around 1 and customers who are around 7. And asking the question why is much more important than getting the actual metric, the sort of statistic on their perception as a group. And that's a whole lot more expensive and a whole lot harder to do, but it gives you more more value as an entrepreneur and how to deal with customers.
Good. Well, maybe we can challenge some of our listeners on what kinds of ways they've figured out to measure the right things, these subjective evaluations, and make them actionable. That would be that would be really an interesting area of research. And to our listeners, please tell us your thoughts on your Austrian dashboard, how you measure subjective value among your customers. You can send your ideas to us at Mises for Business on LinkedIn or on Facebook, or email me, hunter@mises.org, with the subject line Austrian dashboard. We look forward to your ideas. Thank you. So, Per, we've covered our five principles: consumer sovereignty, figure out how to put the consumer in charge; subjective value, understand the consumer's experience; the dynamic resource allocation, dynamic organization, and measuring the right things, which is a bit speculative at this time, but we know the direction we want to move in. So would anything else that you would add to that to leave our entrepreneurs with in terms of execution?
I don't think so. I mean, it's the general fundamental principle. Just always think of the consumer and what the consumer might value. What is the consumer experience? What is the consumer value? What will consumers want more of, and what will they want less of?
Good. Well, I think that is the fundamental principle that we're trying to get across here in Economics for Entrepreneurs. So thank you, as always, for your elucidation of that. We look forward to the next time we get to chat. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. You can follow Hunter Hastings at HunterHastings.com.